Welcome to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiya. Remember when Condoleezza Rice warned us that we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud? When the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, the world got a good long look at what the Bush White House called preventive war. A few years later, we learned about the 1% doctrine, Vice President Cheney's post-9/11 formula for U.S. military intervention. According to author Ron Suskind, if there's a 1% chance that terrorists can get hold of a weapon of mass destruction, the U.S. must act as if it's a certainty. That's Cheney's view. But what is our view? What should be the rules regarding a preemptive strike or preventive war? When is it appropriate and when is it a crime?
Everything's a matter of degree. The essence of a civilized society is line drawing, where you draw the lines. And that's exactly what we don't have in jurisprudence. We haven't decided where to draw the lines.
That's the attorney, author, blogger, and Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz talking. In his new book called Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways, he asks us to consider a new set of laws governing preemptive action, laws which would prohibit some acts and permit others. Alan Dershowitz, welcome to ThoughtCast.
Thank you so much for having me on this wonderful, wonderful show.
You're welcome. Now, what we're talking about here is a set of practices like targeted assassinations, the detention and possible torture of terror suspects, preemptive strikes, perhaps on a hostile country's nuclear plants. And these activities are supposed to be illegal, but countries do go ahead and do them anyway. The U.S. is one of those countries, isn't it?
The United States engaged, really for the first time in our history, in a full-blown preventive war in Iraq. We had previously thought about taking preventive or preemptive actions and come close to it. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, there had been some who had argued for a preventive attack on the Soviet nuclear capacity back in the 1940s, and cooler minds prevailed. But Iraq is the first instance of a full-blown preventive war, and I think most analysts would say an example of a failed use of that doctrine.
In your book, Alan, you don't spell out exactly what you think these new laws should say, but it's pretty clear that you want them watered down a bit. You write that, quote, "While it may be necessary for democracies to fight terrorists with one hand tied behind their backs, it is neither necessary nor desirable for a democracy to fight with two hands tied behind its back, especially when the ropes that bind the second hand are anachronistic laws that can be changed without compromising legitimate human rights." You've written a lot about torture, Alan. What do you think about those laws? Are they anachronistic?
They're not anachronistic so much as they're utterly useless. Every country says it's wrong to torture. Every country has signed on to anti-torture treaties. And every country faced with terrorism tortures, has tortured, and will torture. Great Britain did it, of course, during the Irish Northern Ireland problem. The French did it in Algeria. England did it in Kenya. The Russians do it routinely. The Egyptians do it routinely. The Jordanians, the Philippines.
So how can it be illegal?
There are many things that are illegal. Adultery used to be illegal, and it was very widespread.
Things are illegal. Why do we have these laws?
Well, because we aspire to a time when torture will never be used. And I have a different suggestion. Instead of being hypocritical and everybody proclaiming never, never, never torture, never will use it, I'm suggesting the following. Though I'm against torture, and I wish we never had to use it, I believe it's going on. And therefore, I propose that before torture or even any rough interrogation can ever be used, the president personally has to sign a torture warrant, which would be approved by the Chief Justice of the United States. That would make it almost impossible for any democracy ever to justify torture. We could never have gotten a president to sign a torture warrant for Abu Ghraib, which were low-level detainees who had no information, and we used methods that no American president would approve, sexual humiliation, etc. So my proposal is designed to pragmatically eliminate or at least reduce to an absolute minimum the amount of torture, in contrast to the present situation where everybody is happy, we outlaw torture, and it just goes on its merry way underneath the radar screen.
But I think you want to make a distinction, don't you, between certain acts that are currently labeled as torture, but are really, you think, acceptable under the circumstances, and acts which really are the true, genuine article.
Well, I think we have to make distinctions all the time. There's a difference between torturing somebody to death the way Stalin and Hitler did, and what Britain did or Israel did or other countries did, use very, very rough interrogation methods, shaking people, putting blindfolds on them, exposing them to hot and cold, but not endangering their lives. I would actually like to broaden the definition of torture to include all of these things and to include waterboarding, which the United States now does, putting somebody on a board and lowering his head into the water, and saying that none of these things should ever be permitted unless we are prepared to have the president sign a torture warrant. The analogy I make is to an airplane loaded with civilians heading toward the Empire State Building, and it has 15 minutes before it's going to crash and kill 10,000 people. Somebody has to make the decision to shoot down that airplane. It should be the president, not some low-ranking official on the ground. In a democracy, you need accountability for the worst things, for the most extreme things, and that's been my very controversial proposal regarding torture.
You're listening to ThoughtCast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiya, and I'm speaking with the author and Harvard Law professor, Alan Dershowitz. As you know, you've written that these laws can be changed without compromising legitimate human rights. Mm-hmm. You don't see this as compromising legitimate human rights?
If, in fact, the end result is less torture, we are, in fact, promoting, not compromising human rights. It doesn't promote human rights simply to say don't torture and then turn a blind eye to the actual torture that goes on.
But by writing legitimate human rights, you're implying that there are human rights that really aren't legitimate.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the worst abuses today that occur in the world are in the name of human rights. Hezbollah and Hamas could not exist but for our absurd human rights laws that are totally anachronistic. Hezbollah and Hamas thrive by hiding behind civilians. They use civilians as human shields. And then they say to the democracies, look, you have two choices. Either let us continue to kill your civilians, which is a great victory for Hezbollah, or else come after us. And if you come after us, you will kill our civilians. And when you do, we will yell, human rights, and you will become war criminals, and you will become subject to abuse by the United Nations and criticism all over the world. It's a wonderful win-win for the terrorists, and it's a lose-lose for democracy. And it's all the fault of absurd human rights laws that don't understand that when you take a human shield, it's you, the person who takes the human shield, who's violating human rights, not the person who, in a legitimate effort to try to prevent the killing of civilians, accidentally kills a civilian in the process. An analogy. Let's assume somebody robs a bank and takes a teller as a hostage and shoots from behind the teller and kills civilians. And then the policeman has to try to kill the robber who is shooting, and he accidentally kills the hostage. Who's guilty of murder? Not the policeman, whose bullet killed the hostage, but in fact the person who was hiding behind the hostage. That should be true of international human rights law as well. All the responsibility for civilians killed when terrorists hide behind civilians should be laid at the doorstep of the terrorists, not the democracies that have to fight with one hand tied behind their back.
This may not be the real world, but in the movies, there are always these scenes where there's a moral choice. The, let's say, policeman doesn't shoot because that person has a hostage. We always see that. They give their gun to the bad guy. Why isn't that the appropriate response?
Sometimes it is. If the person who is at risk and could be killed, and the only danger is perhaps killing one civilian, you don't do it. But if the person who has the hostage has already killed six civilians and he's shooting into crowds and you can't clear the crowds, and it's a matter of 100 civilians, you take the risk. It's always going to be a matter of degree. It's always going to be a matter of proportionality. And the essence of a democracy is proportionality and resolving matters of degree with accountability and democratically.
Alan, I know that you request and like tough questions.
Yes.
So I've done my best with one.
Please.
You're well known as a strong supporter of Israel.
Right.
And a cynic might think that your desire to change these rules regarding torture and other preemptive tactics is actually a public relations move. It could be seen as a way to give the U.S. and Israel legal and diplomatic cover for some of the acts that other countries find so objectionable.
It's an excellent question. And if the proposals that I were making were to help a tyrannical regime, a regime that was doing all the wrong things, it seems to me one could easily make that criticism that I started from trying to defend Israel and move backward toward the procedures that I'm suggesting, or the United States. That just isn't the case. What I'm doing is coming up with ideas that I think are very ancient in their roots, Ideas that I've had, by the way, for a long, long time. I've written about these things well before the current Israeli conflict or the current American law. And also, I'm very critical of many things Israel does. I'm very critical, for example, of its house destruction policy, and I've been critical of that for a long time. I'm very critical of the settlement policy in Israel. I don't think that there should have been civilian settlements in the West Bank. I'm very critical of some of its failures in respect to building up the Palestinian Authority after the death of Yasser Arafat. So I'm perfectly willing to criticize Israel, and I'm certainly willing to criticize the United States. I'm very critical of the Bush administration. I was against the war in Iraq, though for me it was a close question. I was one of those people who fell for the intelligence. I believe there were weapons of mass destruction, and I still was 51-49 against the war in Iraq because of the law of unintended consequences, because I thought it would divert attention away from Iran, which posed a more serious threat, and because I'd rather face an enemy who fears death than an enemy who welcomes death. So I'd rather face a secular enemy than a religious fundamentalist enemy.
Why didn't Bush think that way?
I think Bush has a worldview that is a macro view, and it's not one I share, and he sees the issues as part of this worldview. And the worldview is a great conflict between democracies and terrorism, democracies and tyranny, and anything that contributes to the right resolution of that kind of apocalyptic worldview is something that I think he will push. Now, I don't agree with that worldview, though I do agree with some of the Bush administration's policies. And by the way, most of the ones that I agree with were also part of the Clinton policy. Take, for example, the issue of preemptive or preventive war. The Clinton administration came up with that first as a policy. And I believe that if we had a Democratic president now, whether it would be Clinton or Gore or Kerry, we would be equally concerned about Iran and would be having some planning for a potential preventive or preemptive attack on Iran. I absolutely agree with Cheney's formulation of the 1% principle with one exception. Now, I think a 1% risk of a nuclear catastrophe is in many ways the equivalent of 100% risk. You do not accept a 1% risk of nuclear catastrophe in the world, but it depends on what the options are. If that risk could be dissipated with no risk to civilians, the way Israel destroyed the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981 with the loss of no Iraqi lives and the loss of only one French technician, that's the right thing to do. But if it takes the killing of 100,000 people to eliminate that 1% risk, then it's not acceptable to do that. Then you need a higher level of risk than 1%. And in my book, Preemption, I try to actually create some mathematical formulas for looking at how to weigh risks against consequences, the risks of action versus the risks of inaction. One of the reasons I'm not ready yet to write laws regulating the use of preemptive or preventive warfare is I don't think we've done the hard intellectual work of thinking through these issues. And my book, Preemption, purports to be the initial kind of intellectual contribution to how we should think about these things, how we should evaluate the costs and benefits of preemption and prevention. And only after we've had years of debate should we be prepared to codify that into laws that are supposed to look to the future.
You're listening to ThoughtCast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiya, and I'm talking with the Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz about his new book called Preemption, The Knife That Cuts Both Ways. Alan Dershowitz, you have a charming parable from the Bible, which you tell in your book, Preemption. Would you mind repeating it about the conversation God has about numbers?
It's my favorite story from the Bible, and it involves my favorite character from the Bible, Abraham, after whom I'm named. My Hebrew name is Avraham, which is the Hebrew for Abraham. Abraham was, of course, the world's first recorded lawyer, and he had a heck of a client, the sinners of Sodom, as in Sodom and Gomorrah, the two great evil cities of the book of Genesis. And it wasn't as if he had to defend them only against charges of consensual homosexuality. That would be easy even for a biblical character, but these were predatory rapists, according to at least the tradition. And Abraham had to defend them. And he argues with God, and he says, God, what if There are 50 innocent people among the many who are guilty. And God says, that's a good argument. If there are 50, I will spare the entire city. And Abraham, the great lawyer, figures he has him on principle. Now let's start bargaining over numbers. What if it's 45? What if it's 40? What if it's 30? What if it's 20? But he stops at 10, and that's critical. And for me, that shows two things. First of all, this is the first example of rights being a matter of degree, and it's also the first example of an attempt to quantify morality. Killing 5 or 6 innocent people to save a whole city might be legitimate, but killing 15 or 20 might not be legitimate. And when the governor of the former governor of Illinois decided to commute the death sentences of everybody on death row after he discovered 30 or so potentially innocent people, he basically was following the story of Sodom. And my interpretation of the story is God was saying to Abraham, look, you can't ever, ever have a perfect system. Strive for a system that's as good as possible. Strive for a system in which if there are too many innocent people, reconsider and reevaluate the system. But if occasionally there might be an innocent person, that's the limitations of humanity. And you're human and you will make mistakes. Just err on the side of making mistakes, freeing the guilty rather than convicting the innocent.
Alan Dershowitz, with that in mind, that mistakes are made, critics have been pointing out their concern that your desire to change and think through the laws of preemption really opened the door to dictatorships benefiting from these changes in the law as well. I mean, do we want them pulling out Dershowitz's new international laws to defend their actions?
It would make no difference. Tyrants and dictators are going to do what they're going to do anyway. The only countries that comply with the rule of law are democracies. And so, anything you do, any rule you make will be abused by tyrants. Remember when the Soviet Union under Stalin was executing people, they were always invoking the rule of law. They were invoking American principles. At Nuremberg, the Nazis defended themselves based on American laws. There's always going to be abuse of law. To me, the issue is not what rules will regulate tyrants. They're going to be lawless. The issue for me is what rules should regulate democracies. And we make mistakes on both sides. If we preempt, and we shouldn't have preempted, that's a serious mistake. But failing to preempt can be a very serious mistake. If Israel had not taken out the Iraqi nuclear reactor, Iraq would today be in Kuwait. Saddam Hussein would still be in power. That would be the most powerful regime in the Middle East. And the world would be a very, very different place. Let me give you an example of a preventive war that should have been fought and wasn't fought. In 1935, if the British and the French had gone in with full force and destroyed the Nazi war machine in the emerging Hitler regime, we could have saved millions and millions and millions of lives. That would have been a preventive war worth fighting. Winston Churchill wanted to fight that war. Neville Chamberlain didn't. Neville Chamberlain is now the poster child for collaboration or failure to take on evil. Whereas Winston Churchill is the hero of being able to confront evil. Sometimes prevention is absolutely necessary.
What happens to what you said earlier in our interview when you said that preemptive laws, the ones we've been discussing, are currently considered to be illegal because we're aiming higher than that? If you encourage a law that gives more leeway to these actions, what happens to aiming higher?
I think we ought to aim high, always, but we ought to recognize the failures of humanity, and we ought to understand that we have to, when the law gets too far from what human beings are going to do, and the law is completely ignored, the law fails. And, for example, take the United Nations Charter. It has a high aspiration. Articles 50 and 51 say that no country may use armed force unless it is attacked first. No preemptive war, no preventive war. It literally means that when Israel was on the verge of potential destruction with the Syrian army and the Egyptian army about to attack it, it had to wait and absorb the first blow. What if it was a nuclear attack? It would have to absorb the first blow. No country is going to do that. As Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State of the United States, once said, a nation's survival will never be a matter of law.
But as you know, the UN is amending this.
The UN has not amended it. What it has is appointed a committee to reinterpret it. It won't amend it. And it's a very interesting distinction. It won't amend it because it wants to keep the aspiration high. I think that's hypocritical. It ought to amend it explicitly, and it ought to say explicitly that when there is a significant chance that a nation will be attacked, the nation not only has the right but has the duty to attack first. If the United States had learned about the Japanese plan to bomb Pearl Harbor, we would have been right to destroy the Japanese Air Force on the ground. Now, there's a terrible problem with this method of thinking. It never stops. And if Japan had learned about the United States planning to destroy its Air Force, would they have had the right to destroy our Air Force?
It's like a Russian doll. There's always something.
There's always something in the next when you open it up. And that's the danger. On the other hand, every country is going to do it. So let's at least try to regulate it with some thoughtful, moral, and legal constraints when you have the right to do it. And the likelihood has to be fairly high. It should depend on the catastrophic nature of the likelihood. But Cheney may be right or wrong as a matter of morality, but he is certainly right as a matter of practicality. No president of the United States could survive by going to the American public and saying, members of the public, we have learned of a 1% chance that our nation will be destroyed by a nuclear power. We can destroy that power, and we're not going to do it because 1% is not high enough. No president or prime minister could survive after making that speech, and rightfully so.
Listening to Thoughtcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. Alan, you were mentioning the United Nations, and as you know, we have trouble enough getting anything passed there. There's a very, very hard time getting any agreement. How would you get this law passed and enforced? And who would do the passing and the enforcing?
It's very, very hard today to get anything done at the United Nations because the United Nations is a democracy of tyrannies. That is, the vast majority of countries in the United Nations are tyrannies. They have no democracy, and each of the tyrannies gets a vote at the General Assembly. So it would have to be passed through the Security Council, and the Security Council has vetoes, and some of the countries in the Security Council wouldn't be interested in changing these laws. Look, we were fortunate enough to get laws enacted, the UN Charter, when there was a consensus following the Second World War. It's much harder to change rules of this kind.
So how would you get this law passed?
I think what you do is you don't pass it. You develop it through customary international law. You develop it through academic writing first, and then over time, it becomes the consensus. Let me give you a perfect example. When Israel attacked the Osirik nuclear reactor in 1981, the world condemned it. The United Nations condemned it. The Security Council condemned it. And the United States joined the condemnation. Several years later, the United States wrote letters to Israel praising it for having done that. And if you go into international law textbooks today, they point to the Israeli attack on the Osirik reactor as a paradigm of proportional preventive war. So the rules have now changed. In this report that has now been done for the United Nations at the request of Secretary General Kofi Annan, they point to various preemptive actions that have been taken in the past and say those are now justified. That's the way international law develops. International law is self-enforcing because the only organs that can enforce it, the International Court of Justice, is a fraud. The International Court of Justice is not a court. It's a group of judges who come from countries, mostly tyrannies, who vote their country's orders. And so you can't trust the International Court of Justice to enforce the law fairly, which is why their rulings are not binding on any nations. They're just advisory, and that, thankfully, they're just advisory because they've written some terrible, terrible decisions that no teacher of international law today takes seriously.
But a law that you're suggesting that isn't really passed and is enforced in this sort of nebulous way would be even weaker.
I'm not looking for a law. I'm looking for a consensus. I'm looking for democracies and for international law professors and serious people to change their perception of what is permissible. And that's occurring as we speak. Preemption today is acceptable under international law, notwithstanding the Charter of the United Nations. And the new commission recognizes the reality that that's the case and that they can't move the clock back. And that's what I'm looking for, an acknowledgement that we're now fighting a new kind of war, a war against terrorism, a war against terrorists who hide behind civilians, a war against terrorists who target civilians. And we can't allow the past anachronistic international law to be used both as a shield and as a sword for the terrorists in their war against democracy. We have to understand that changes in the understanding of the law have to be recognized by democracies. It's only the democracies that count. Who cares what Iran thinks about the law or what North Korea thinks about the law? But we care deeply what Great Britain thinks about the law. We care what Germany thinks, what Italy, what the United States thinks about the law.
Alan Dershowitz, why can't Iran someday have the ability to be the one who enacts these laws? We will someday perhaps be a little weaker than we are now.
It's always possible. Look, Iran, in my lifetime as a young man, was not ever a democracy under the Shah, but it had rights for women. It was moving perhaps in the right direction over time. It was more secular. It was an ally of the United States. And look how dramatically that changed with the emergence of the Ayatollah Khomeini. It could change back. One of the great reasons I want to see peace in the Middle East is I think a Palestinian democracy could be a secular, intellectual, scientific mecca. Palestinian people are wonderful people. They have been badly ruled and led over the past 75 years, but given an opportunity to develop a democracy, and if they choose to reject Hamas and move toward a more secular leadership, and there are many good leaders among the Palestinians, we could see a mecca of democracy in that part of the world.
Alan, let's take a look at some specifics. On July 12th, Hezbollah crossed the border into northern Israel, kidnapped two soldiers, and killed several others. Israel then responded, at first with an intensive bombing campaign, but Hezbollah still managed to fire around 100 rockets a day into northern Israel. Can the doctrine of preemption shed any light on this?
Israel didn't have to use preemption because they were attacked, even under the UN Charter, and even Kofi Annan acknowledged Israel had a right of self-defense. The question is proportionality. One of the most difficult issues, intellectually, legally, and morally, is proportionality to what? Proportionality to what happened in the past, or proportionality to the threat of the future? And international law looks at proportionality in terms of the threat of the future. So if, for example, country A attacks country B and kills one soldier, it would not be proportional to bomb its nuclear reactor. But if the threat posed by the killing of the one soldier was that it will then send nuclear bombs, you can then go in and destroy its nuclear reactor.
What's the logic there?
The logic is that you look, when you define proportionality, not at what has happened in the past, but what the threat that's posed. Is the action proportionate to the threat that's posed? And the threat that Hezbollah posed against Israel was 10,000 rockets being rained down on its civilians. The two soldiers were the trigger. But it would be disproportionate to attack the infrastructure of Hezbollah if Hezbollah said, oh, we just killed two soldiers, that's all we're going to do, here they are back. What happened there was Hezbollah captured two soldiers, killed more, crossed over, and continued its rain of rockets. Remember, the rockets didn't start on that day. Rockets had hit northern Israel for years preceding that time. And so Israel correctly perceived that if it was going to go in and try to rescue its soldiers, which it was entitled to do, the response would be a rain of rockets. And so it was entitled to prevent that from happening as well. Let me give you another example. If Israel ever decided to attack Iran's nuclear reactor, it wouldn't be doing it in proportion to what Iran has already done to Israel, which has mostly been verbal and providing weapons to Hezbollah. It would be because the future threat was so great that the destruction of the Iraqi, or Iranian in this case, nuclear reactor would be proportional to the potential threat in the future. So that's the serious intellectual issue. Proportional to what?
You're listening to ThoughtCast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. Alan Dershowitz, in terms of who's doing the preempting, I did read that this counterattack by Israel actually had been planned over a year earlier. So maybe it was really more premeditated, and they were perhaps responding to the secret buildup by Hezbollah of their artillery.
That's always going to be the case. Any decent democracy, the United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, Israel, always have contingency plans. If you're attacked, you don't just attack back. You attack and make sure that the counterattack is neutralized. So there's always going to be a long-term plan. And a cynic can say, they used the soldiers as an excuse for an attack that they were ready to use. That's not the case. They knew that by taking proportional action to get their soldiers back, that Hezbollah would be raining massive rockets on them, and they had to take action designed to prevent Hezbollah from taking that action.
What would have been proportional?
Well,
to just the two soldiers?
It's hard to imagine a situation where anybody would just come in and take two soldiers without having rockets behind them. If there were no rockets, proportional would have been to block the escape routes, to try to retrieve the soldiers, perhaps to capture some Hezbollah militants to exchange for the soldiers, but certainly not destroying the rockets. But because Hezbollah had rockets, which they had threatened to use, it was entirely proportional to try to knock out their capacity to do it.
Alan Dershowitz, you've written that since terrorists don't fear death and have no home address, so to speak, that they can't be deterred by the usual methods, which are basically punishment after the fact. And you argue that the only recourse left against terrorists is preemption. Could Israel have preempted this war?
First of all, terrorists can be deterred, but not through democratic means. Stalin and Hitler deterred terrorism. They killed the family members. Even, it is alleged more recently, when Hezbollah captured some American diplomats and some a Russian diplomat, no one can confirm this, but the story has been circulating for years, that the KGB, the Russian intelligence, came in and murdered the families of the Hezbollah kidnappers, and nobody was kidnapped again after that by Hezbollah, who belonged to the Soviet Union. So it would be possible, theoretically, to deter suicide bombers, but no democracy will ever engage in the kind of actions that would be necessary to do it. So the next question is, what's an appropriate preventive action? Yes, Israel could have taken preventive action. It could have, in the middle of the night, with no warning, gone in and destroyed the Hezbollah rockets. By the way, if Israel were going to attack Iran for their nuclear reactor, I think they would have first neutralized Hezbollah's rockets before they did it, or simultaneously, because they knew that an attack in Iran would stimulate the rockets from Hezbollah. So sometimes when you're going to take one preemptive action, you have to take multiple preemptive actions to preempt what you are inciting in some ways by your other preemptive action. It's very complicated.
Not to get too bogged down in tactics, but how could the Israelis in the middle of the night actually go and locate all these hidden bombs, these hidden rockets?
Be very difficult. You'd need massive intelligence on the ground. One of the reasons why Israel did not have particularly good intelligence in southern Lebanon is because they had left. And many of the people who they had been collaborating with in the past, southern Lebanese Christians, had been arrested by Hezbollah or thrown out of the area. So Israel did not have good intelligence on the ground. You'll notice there's much more terrorism from southern Lebanon and from Gaza against Israel and from the West Bank. Why? Because Israel engages in preemptive actions in the West Bank because of its occupation. Put another way, occupation doesn't cause terrorism. That's easily proved. Many countries that have been occupied have not had terrorism, Tibet and other countries. But terrorism causes occupation. And that is one of the reasons Israel occupied Lebanon was to prevent terrorism. The reason it remains in the West Bank is to prevent terrorism. It would have left Gaza much earlier. So there's much less terrorism in the West Bank than there is in the Gaza and in Hezbollah. And one of the reasons is because Israel has an extraordinary intelligence presence on the West Bank at great cost, because it creates all kinds of tensions between Palestinians and Israelis and the checkpoints and all the difficulties that any occupation entails.
But one of those costs is, I think you would agree, more terrorism.
No, I don't agree with that. I don't think terrorism is stimulated by occupation or by the actions that result from it. I think that you might get more volunteers to become suicide bombers, but suicide bombers don't send themselves. They are sent by elite, well-educated people like Osama bin Laden, who never lived in an occupied country in his life. So I think terrorism is a tactic of choice, chosen by certain cultures and not other cultures. And suicide terrorism particularly is a tactic chosen by only a very small number of cultures. And particularly radical Islam has chosen suicide terrorism as an option of great success because you can't deter a suicide terrorist.
Alan Dershowitz, speaking of what's right and wrong, you wrote in an editorial in the Boston Herald recently that, quote, Israel has, of course, rightly apologized for the deaths in Qana, a town in Lebanon where a lot of civilians died after an aerial attack. But why is it right to apologize if Hezbollah is to blame, as you have argued?
If I were to be running down the street in my car and a six-month-old child or a two-year-old child ran out in front of my car in a way that I couldn't possibly see the child and I killed the child, it would be utterly not my fault. There would be nothing I could do to have prevented that. I was driving within the speed limit. I was perfectly sober. My car was in perfect condition and I killed the child. I would apologize for killing the child even though I did nothing wrong. And I think when your vehicle or your rocket results in the death of innocent people, you apologize and you show grief. I would be grief-stricken if I killed a child, but I wouldn't have done anything wrong. It would not have been my fault. So Israel apologized for something that was largely the fault of Hezbollah. It was a setup by Hezbollah. They knew that the house had civilians in it. The Israelis did not. They purposely fired from within 30 yards behind the house in order to elicit Israeli fire. There is even some reports now in the blogosphere about some very questionable circumstances surrounding the house. Were bodies brought into the house afterward? Were there really that many bodies? The numbers given by the Red Cross now are considerably less, but the whole thing was a setup. Hezbollah's happiest day was the day in which the Lebanese civilians were killed and the international community had an outcry against Israel, and Israel was forced to stop its aerial bombardment for 2 days. It was the greatest victory of Hezbollah to have Israel kill whatever number of Lebanese civilians were killed.
But Israel knows this. Why do they play into Hezbollah's hands?
What choice does a democracy like Israel have when rockets are raining down and killing its civilians? Man riding a bike who comes from Newton, Massachusetts, whose family, many of us know, was killed because a rocket landed not so close to him, but because the rockets manufactured in Syria and Iran have shrapnel in them designed to spread as far as possible and kill as many civilians as possible, killed this innocent man riding his bike. No democracy, not the United States, not Great Britain, not France, would tolerate rockets being sent over its border and killing its civilians. Israel has to respond to the rockets. And the Hezbollah, by firing the rockets from behind civilians who had been given an option to leave, who tore up, many of them, the leaflets that said leave, the fault for that is 100% with Hezbollah. But if there's any other fault, it's with the international community and the human rights community, because by blaming Israel, they encourage Hezbollah to do this again and again. And the hands of organizations like Human Rights Watch are filled with blood today, because when they blame Israel exclusively, they send a message to Hezbollah: hide behind more civilians. Human Rights Watch is on your side. Kill more Israeli civilians and cause Israel to kill more civilians from Lebanon. Human Rights Watch will be on your side. Human Rights Watch and other organizations that single out Israel for condemnation have blood on their hands.
You're listening to ThoughtCast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. Alan Dershowitz, speaking of what other options Israel might have had other than respond to the rockets, and speaking of blogs as well, on the Huffington Post, which is a blog mm-hmm. where you write, you challenged your readers to come up with, quote, a better alternative for Israel than to try to destroy Hezbollah's rockets, even at the cost of some civilian casualties, unquote. And I am assuming you think nobody's been able to come up with a better idea.
Well, people have come up with ideas. People have said, do nothing, be Gandhi, die. It's not worth living if you have to kill civilians. I've heard those ideas, but no democracy could ever survive. Remember, Gandhi didn't live in a democracy. Gandhi made his own decisions. Mandela certainly didn't sit back passively and allow his people to die. He engaged in counter-terrorist actions. And any other democracy is going to respond by trying to prevent terrorists from killing its own civilians. That's just a law of human nature.
I think the concern is that by responding, that then elicits more rockets and a cycle which ends up killing more Israelis and Lebanese civilians.
Well, that if that were true, it would be stupid. And people don't get elected, mostly, if they do stupid things which end up killing more of their own people. Obviously, the citizens of Israel think differently, and they think that by responding to rocket attacks and trying to destroy the rockets, fewer Israeli civilians will be killed. Now, the hard moral question is a democracy entitled to prefer its own civilians over the civilians of an enemy country, particularly if some of those civilians are collaborators? Now, not all the civilians are collaborators. Obviously, children and elderly and people who can't leave are not collaborators. But does a democracy have the right to say, we prefer the lives of our citizens over the lives of your citizens? Now, that's a hard moral question. The United States answered that yes at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The British answered it yes in Dresden. The French answered it yes repeatedly throughout their history. And Israel has answered it yes by taking what it believes are proportional actions. Reasonable people could disagree about whether it's proportional or not, and that's a fair debate as long as it's put in context of what other countries have done over time.
Speaking
let me make one more point.
Please.
The other point that deserves some focus is at a time when Israel may have been responsible for killing hundreds of Lebanese, during that same period, Arabs and Muslims killed thousands of Arabs and Muslims in the Sudan, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in other parts of the world. The world doesn't focus attention on that. When Muslims kill Muslims, it's not a story. When Arabs kill Arabs, it's not a story. But when Jews kill Arabs, that's a story. That gets international focus. That cannot be a moral way to look at these things. If all lives are worth the same, then it doesn't matter who does the killing. And Israel's killing is far more justified in the interest of stopping terrorism against its own civilians than the killing that's going on in Sudan today with the collaboration of many Arab governments. And you don't see the same focus of attention on those killings, even though there are many, many more of them.
Do you think there would be more attention paid to Israeli deaths if the Hezbollah were better at targeting?
Oh, of course. Oh, no, look, I'm not suggesting that there aren't attention paid to Israeli deaths. There are attention paid to Israeli deaths. In fact, there's too much attention internationally paid to Israel and its conflicts. I wish more attention were paid to the Sudan and to other conflicts in the world, because Israel has killed fewer civilians over its 75-year battle against terrorism than any country in the world facing comparable threats, and yet has gotten disproportional attention to what it has done compared to almost any other country in the world. If you went to the UN today, if you were a space alien who landed at the UN, didn't know anything, just look at the UN documents, you'd say there's only one evil country in the world today, Israel. And the other good countries in the world, like Syria and Libya, are all on the International Human Rights Commission, they're on the Security Council. Israel is disqualified, can't serve on the Security Council. Israel can't serve on the International Human Rights Commission. Israel can't serve in the International Court of Justice. Israel is disqualified from serving on virtually all international bodies, and all the evildoer countries in the world serve regularly on these international bodies, and that's not justice.
Alan, we're talking about unintended consequences of action in wartime. Israel attacks, the Hezbollah attack. I had mentioned that the more Israel responds, the more Israelis die. Another unintended consequence is the backfiring in terms of public relations for Israel.
I think there's a big difference between public relations and whether, in fact, more Israelis die. I don't think more Israelis die. I think Israel takes action designed to protect its citizens, and, in fact, fewer Israelis die. Maybe in the short term more die, but in the long term fewer die. Israel has prevented thousands of acts of terrorism over the years and protected its citizens relatively well against acts of terrorism. Public relations is very different. Israel loses the war of public relations all the time. By the way, so does the United States in general. And it's because many in the world hate democracies, and because, let's face facts about Israel, Israel is the Jewish nation. It's the Jew among nations. And as the Jew among nations, it's treated like the Jews have been treated throughout history, and a double standard is applied to it. There is no way of explaining the disproportionate attacks on Israel at the United Nations other than as the result of bigotry. I think criticism of Israel is valid. I criticize it all the time. And I don't believe that criticism of Israel, legitimate criticism of Israel, is anti-Semitic. But I do believe that anti-Semitism motivates some of the extreme belligerence directed against Israel at the United Nations. Now, many of the diplomats would deny it, but there is no other explanation for the double standard in terms of UN resolutions and in terms of the failure to have resolutions against other countries that are far more violative of international law.
Speaking of diplomats, could Israel have resorted to diplomacy?
Israel has tried to use diplomacy repeatedly. Before the Osirik reactor, Israel tried in every way to get the international community through diplomatic means to stop Iraq from developing a nuclear weapon. Not only did it fail, but France became a collaborator. And France facilitated the development of the Iraqi nuclear reactor. France is a facilitator today in the Iranian nuclear reactor. Russia is a facilitator today. Diplomacy has always failed for Israel, except when it has been able to work through the United States. And when it has succeeded, for example, when Resolution 242 was enacted at the United Nations, it's been flaunted. And nations don't follow the resolutions of the UN that have been supportive of Israel.
But that's the past. Mm-hmm. That's the past. Why not try it now?
I think Israel is trying diplomacy now. It has indicated a willingness to engage in a ceasefire once the vacuum in South Lebanon is filled by an international force with teeth who would prevent Hezbollah from rearming and prevent Hezbollah from showering rockets on Israeli citizens. Diplomacy is always better than war. Negotiations are always better than war. Israel offered the Palestinians a state in 2000 and 2001 through diplomacy. The Palestinians rejected it. Israel was open to giving back all of the captured territories in 67. All the Arab states got together at Khartoum and said three no's, no negotiation, no peace, and no recognition. Israel was prepared to accept the two-state solution in 1948. The Jewish community in Israel was prepared to accept a two-state resolution in 1937 and 1938. So they've tried diplomacy repeatedly over the years, and diplomacy has failed.
Alan Dershowitz, you have written recently that, quote, the Arab world, the Islamic world, and the rest of the Israel haters have now rallied behind Hezbollah. Hatred of Israel has even managed to heal the millennium-long divisions between Shias and Sunnis. This doesn't sound like it's going in the right direction.
Oh, it's not going in the right direction in terms of public relations. It's not going in the right direction in terms of Arab unity. But in my view, and I certainly have heard this from many, many experts, that in the Arab world, the best way to destroy a terrorist organization is to defeat it. When Hezbollah wins, it gets power. And if Hezbollah is permitted to win a war of terrorism against Israel, it will increase its power. When Israel has tried to work in peaceful ways, when it left the Gaza, what happened? That just strengthened Hamas, and Hamas got elected. When it left the south of Lebanon, what happened? It increased the strength of Hezbollah. They armed with 10,000 rockets, and they became supported and powerful throughout the world. So weakness hasn't worked. Peace gestures haven't worked. Land for peace has produced only land for terrorism and land for rockets. The alternatives are not good ones. And the military alternative should always be the last resort and should never be tried until all others have been exhausted. But I think Israel has exhausted other options. It has tried to make peace. It has tried to create a two-state solution. It has tried unilateral withdrawal. It has tried bilateral agreements. Nothing has worked. And the reason it hasn't worked is because Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran are dedicated to the ultimate destruction of Israel. No secret, they say it. It's in their charter. How do you negotiate with a country that says our negotiating position is you shouldn't exist?
Now, this hatred of Israel is not just public relations. This is a serious
It's existential.
Weapon.
Oh, of course.
Because when I asked you that question, when I was reading your quote to you about how the Arabs have rallied behind Hezbollah, you kind of said, well, that's public relations.
That's right.
But it's not just public relations. It's an emotion and it's an ideology that is much more powerful than 3,000 rockets.
It is as powerful as Nazism was powerful in the 1930s. That was powerful. Nazism was powerful. The desire to destroy the Jews was powerful, and it succeeded. The European Jewish community was destroyed. 6 million were killed. And that doesn't mean the United States' effort to destroy Nazism was a failure. It succeeded in the end. And Germany became a democracy, and Austria became a democracy. And so I think efforts have to be made diplomatically, and if the diplomatic efforts fail, militarily, to destroy those who would destroy Israel. Israel cannot sit back and accept its destruction. And if more and more Arab countries seek its destruction, Israel will have to defend itself against more and more Arabs. It has proved itself capable of doing so in the past. And it's extended beyond Arabs. Today, Israel's greatest enemy is not an Arab country. It's Iran, which is a Muslim Persian country. And Israel may eventually have to take military action against Iran if Iran threatens Israel's destruction through nuclear holocaust.
Isn't the challenge, though, Alan, that this kind of hatred, which also extends to the United States, of course, can't be destroyed with bombs?
Yes, it can. Hatred can be destroyed with bombs. I don't care if people hate me. I just care that they don't have the capacity to destroy me. Germans hated the Jews, and it was destroyed by bombs. Stalin hated the Western world, and that was destroyed not by bombs, but by tough economic and other means. And thank God America had a nuclear weapon. Otherwise, it would have been subjected to a reign of terror by Stalin. It's a tragic reality that force sometimes is morally necessary. There's an interesting exchange between Gandhi and Buber. Buber was a great Jewish Hasidic scholar and existential writer. And Gandhi wrote to Buber in the beginning of the Holocaust and said, why don't you do what I did? Lie down in front of the British, sow passive disobedience, and the Nazis will stop killing you. And I'm not quoting now, but essentially what Buber wrote back is, Gandhi, you schmuck, don't you realize you were facing the British? They're moral people. We're facing the Nazis. They're not moral. If we lie down, they'll just roll over us and kill us. And sometimes Gandhi doesn't work. Sometimes Churchill works. And Churchill has to be used when force is necessary to repel force. I don't believe that morality will work with the current Iranian regime. I think that force of some kind may, in the end, become necessary if all diplomatic efforts fail. There are other ways of undermining that regime, diplomatically, through building democracy inside. But in the end, if all of that fails, the very idea of Iran with a nuclear weapon threatening to destroy Israel, threatening to destroy American values, is not something the world can tolerate.
You're listening to ThoughtCast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm talking with the Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz about his new book called Preemption, The Knife That Cuts Both Ways. Alan Dershowitz, you said that hatred can be destroyed by bombs, and you know that the more you bomb, the more hatred is created, but you mentioned that Israel can handle that. My question is the population explosion in the Arab and Muslim world. Israel is surrounded by a sea of Arabs and Muslims.
It turns out today that the two most exaggerated weapons in the world are the two weapons the Arabs have, population and oil. Great population growth weakens a country, doesn't strengthen a country, and great oil reserves make a country lazy. You know, they used to tell the joke, poor Moses, if God had only told him to turn right instead of left, Israel would be sitting in the Persian Gulf. I'm glad that if there is a God, he gave Israel a barren land, a desert land, so that Israel would be encouraged to develop high technology and not dependent on oil. And I think the same thing is true with population. You don't win wars today by breeding more children. You win wars today by serious devotion to science, technology, and economy. And Israel has done a first-rate job doing that, and it doesn't not have to fear the population bomb. The population bomb is a dud.
If we accept your notion that you can militarily defeat hatred and that the population bomb is a dud, nonetheless, there is a motive to try to preempt this hatred, I would think.
Sure.
How can we preempt this hatred?
You would think by offering peace. Israel tried that. It failed. You would think by offering land, Israel tried that. It failed. Everything should be tried before military action is taken. Preemption should always be a last resort. Prevention should always be a last resort. Everything else should be tried first. But we cannot take preemption or prevention off the table. It has to be made part of the armaments of democracy, particularly in its fight against terrorism. You cannot talk logically to Osama bin Laden. You cannot persuade him. You cannot engage in Gandhi-like moral tactics in relation to him. He is an evil man, and the only way to destroy Osama bin Laden is to kill him or to capture him, not to try to change him. And democracies have to be willing to kill and capture. And I think everybody would say that if we could preemptively target Osama bin Laden and kill him, and if we could have done that before 9/11, it would have been the most moral thing we could possibly do. There's the old story about the British soldier who had Adolf Hitler in his sights during the First World War and refused to pull the trigger. We don't know if it's an apocryphal story or not, but if only he had pulled that trigger, if only he had Hitler had been executed instead of being given a light sentence when he was tried for the putsch in Munich. If only, you can't look back. But sometimes the most moral thing to do in the world is to kill an evil person. And we're trained to believe thou shalt not kill. But if killing one evil person can prevent the deaths of many, many good and innocent people, that may be the most moral thing you can do. And I would be happy to be the one to pull the trigger or to pull the switch, because I would never urge anything that I wouldn't personally be prepared to do. And if I could pull the trigger and kill Osama bin Laden, I would be proud to do it, and I would want it written on my tombstone.
Well, on that stirring note, let me thank you for the interview, Alan Dershowitz.
Well, thank you. This was very, very interesting for me, and I enjoyed it very much.
You've been listening to Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard Law professor and author of Preemption, The Knife That Cuts Both Ways. I'm Jenny Atiya, and if you'd like to make a comment, please go to our website at www.thoughtcast.org. You can take it from there.